This is Radio Salam Shalom, the Jewish Muslim podcast brought to you from Bristol, UK. This is episode 4 for the end of October 2008. In episode 4 of the Muslim Jewish podcast from Radio Salam Shalom, we bring you a special edition. We were part of the Cambridge Festival of Ideas, and as part of that festival held in the University of Cambridge, Radio Salam Shalom took part in a discussion on the state of Muslim and Jewish relations. Now, it was chaired by Madge Dresser of Radio Salam Shalom and the staff from the CMJR, that's the Institute of Abrahamic Faiths, at the Centre for Muslim and Jewish Relations at Cambridge University. On the one hand was Sheikh Michael Mamisa, and on the other, Dr. Edward Kessler from the Institute. And they shared their views on the state of relations and the need for improvement. And they were joined by an audience of academics, students, and other interested parties in the Mill Lane lecture rooms in Cambridge recently. In the special broadcast from Radio Salam Shalom, we'll share that entire discussion with you.
From Bristol, UK, welcome to Radio Salam Shalom.
Jews and Muslims talking together. This is Radio Salam Shalom.
Well, good evening. I'd like to welcome you all to this Festival of Ideas event. My name's Madge Dresser, and I'm a reader in history at the University of the West of England in Bristol. And the reason I'm here chairing this meeting is because I, along with Kyle Hannum here, who's the station manager, are associated with Salam Shalom, which is a unique internet radio station and broadcasting project in Bristol, which is unique in Europe, which fosters Muslim-Jewish understanding and dialogue. And we're here tonight to address the questions, how can we foster greater understanding between Muslims and Jews, and what can we do to break the cycle of mutual anger, distrust, and suspicion. And in order to do this, we're very lucky to have two eminent speakers from the Wolf Institute, the Center for Promoting Muslim-Jewish Relations here at Cambridge University, Dr. Edward Kessler and Sheikh Michael Mamisa. And the way we're going to structure this evening is I'm going to introduce them in a little more detail in a moment. I'll just mention to you that we are recording this event. It isn't broadcast live, but we will record this to be broadcast on the radio and on the internet. And if anyone has a problem with that and doesn't want to be included in the final broadcast, they can talk to Kyle over here, who will sort you out. I will just ask you to all turn your phones off if you haven't done so already. And the structure of the evening is this. Both Dr. Kessler and Sheikh Mamisa will give very short presentations of just, they said 7 minutes, which sounds very precise to me, and I'll try to keep them to it. Because the main real purpose of the event is to get all of you talking together and to foster some dialogue and to raise some of the questions that address this important and often thorny topic. So let me just tell you a little bit about our speakers. Dr. Edward Kessler has come to Cambridge, and he founded the Institute of Christian-Jewish Relations in 1998, and then went on to form the Center for Muslim-Jewish Relations, which became the Wolf Institute. He came by way of Leeds, where he did Hebrew studies, and then Harvard, where he did an MA in theological studies. A stint in the family business for a few years, and then his PhD in Cambridge was on the sacrifice of Isaac and looking at that subject through the prism of Jewish-Christian relations. That is Edward Kessler's background here, and the Institute promotes dialogue both through e-learning courses, through schools programs, and through series of talks such as these, and I'm sure research as well. And you'll see that Dr. Kessler's books are there to have a look at after the talk. Now, Sheikh Michael Mamisa is also someone who brings a lot of erudition to this evening. born in Zanzibar and raised in Zimbabwe. He did his undergraduate work in both Cairo at the Al-Huzair University in Islamic and Arabic and also at the Rand Afrikaans University in South Africa. He did his MPhil at the Center for Muslim-Christian Relations at the University of Birmingham and is now in his PhD at the doing his PhD at the University of Cambridge in Classical Arabic. And he teaches at the Wolfe Institute, and I'm told that Sheikh is the honorific title for someone who is qualified theologically to teach Muslim theology. And so he said, don't come to him for good oil prices. He's not that sort of Sheikh. So we'll start now, and what we're going to do is to ask both speakers what they see as the three most important issues around the whole notion of promoting better dialogue and understanding between Muslims and Jews. So we'll start with Dr. Kessler, and then Sheikh Mumisa will follow.
Thanks very much, Madge, and thank you very much, everyone, for coming this evening. The way we're going to approach the question is I'm going to ask it from a Jewish perspective. Why is it important for Jews to engage in conversation and dialogue with Muslims? And Michael will be looking at it from the Islamic perspective. Why is it important for Muslims to engage with Jews? We will try to keep to 7 minutes, though what I've just said is not part of that 7 minutes, anybody who is timing me. So why is it crucial for Jews to have good relations with the world of Islam? Well, there are many, many important reasons to have a stable relationship with the varieties of cultures and peoples of Islam. Perhaps most important is the fact that Islam is very much part of the Abrahamic triangle. Islam has a world population of something like 1.6 billion, including 57 nations, one of which is a nuclear power today, and in the next few days, doubtless, there will be several more joining the nuclear club. It is estimated by the middle of this century, one out of four people on this planet will be Muslim. The political unrest in the Muslim world is causing global turmoil. The plight of the Palestinians, the people of Kashmir, Chechnya, Muslims in the Balkans, and so on, have caused global anger and anguish amongst Muslims. And the problem of all these peoples need to be resolved after so many decades of suffering. About 80% of the world's refugees are Muslim. And it's important for Jews, in particular, to understand Islam because Israel, the only Jewish state, is situated in the heart of the Muslim world. And we need to create an environment of goodwill and friendship so that the peoples of that region, both Israelis and Palestinians, can live as friendly neighbours in the security and the peace they deserve. And this brings me to my first point. The first issue I think that's absolutely vital in the Jewish understanding and approach to Islam is to take seriously the prejudice and the ignorance that exists both in Islam and amongst Muslims and amongst Jews. When I read about some forms of anti-Semitism that appear in the Arab media, or I'm told about that we know that these Jews control the world through their conspiracy, I've read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, I was once told, I don't see, I don't hear enough of my fellow Muslims condemning such fabrication and such lies. The stereotyping of Jews amongst many Muslims is extremely damaging and harmful. It develops distrust and hatred, and it can function like a spark. But what about the other side? What about within the Jewish community? We have a very similar problem, a problem of ignorance, a problem of prejudice. I constantly read about books that tell me the truth about Islam. I look at the writings of some neocons, some of whom are Jewish, and I read the same sorts of lies and defamation and ignorance in the Jewish press. So the first thing we need to overcome is we need to overcome this ignorance, we need to overcome this prejudice, and we do that by basic faith literacy, basic faith learning. The second point is the dialogue that does exist is overshadowed in both communities by the failings, the failure to address the impact of the Middle East conflict on our communities. And I think understanding what lies behind this failure is key to the future success of the Jewish-Muslim conversation. It's not about solving it, because here we are sitting in Cambridge, we're not going to solve a political problem. But if somehow we can understand the perceptions, we Jews can understand the perceptions amongst Muslims about the problem of Palestine, then perhaps we move forward. For Jews, of course, the creation of the State of Israel is an ancient promise fulfilled. The ingathering of exiles, the creation of a vibrant nation state, guaranteeing physical and spiritual security. We need to get that across to our Muslim partners in our conversation. But for many Muslims, the permanent existence of a Jewish state in the Middle East is a religious and political anomaly. We need to recognize that because Jewish-Muslim dialogue lies so far behind Jewish-Christian dialogue, in the sense of it's a relatively recent phenomenon, we have to be prepared for conflicting views. An authentic encounter must allow for sharp differences. We Jews have to hear that many Muslims view the creation of Israel not as a national act of liberation after 2,000 years of powerlessness, but a Nakba, a disaster, when an Islamic society was uprooted and became a minority in a land that was once Islamic. Muslims need to hear from Jews that we do not separate Zionism from its religious roots, and that an attempt to distinguish between Zionism and Judaism is a failure to understand Judaism. Zionism is an integral component of Judaism and not a racist ideology. That's point number two. And the point number three is that we Jews need to acknowledge what we do share in common with Muslims, particularly in this country, the fact that we are both minority groups. Probably for the first time in the history of the world, Muslims and Jews are living together as minorities. Normally it's Jews living as a minority in Islamic lands or in Christendom, but here we are minorities together. Here we are, in a way, in a diaspora. Here we have the possibility of building the bridges, of building mutual trust and respect by organizing, for instance, reciprocal visits to the mosque and the synagogue as we do in our courses. We need to invite our Muslim partners to our houses for Shabbat or for Passover. We can help each other maintain a distinctive religious identity. We have to realize that when a Jewish cemetery is desecrated on Monday, by a Wednesday, it's the Muslim cemetery. We face the same problems in fighting Islamophobia and in fighting anti-Semitism. Now, if the challenges of Muslim-Jewish relations seem daunting, in my view, they are less so than the challenge of Jewish-Christian relations 100 years ago. And the fact that during the last 100 years, and in particular since 1965 and Vatican II, there has been a transformation in the Christian understanding of its relationship with Jews and Judaism, in my view, that provides the seeds of hope. For example, the creation of the Center for the Study of Muslim-Jewish Relations that both Michael and I work for is the only center of its type that now delivers courses in the study of Muslim-Jewish relations. Radio stations like Radio Salam Shalom, public letters by Muslims to the Jewish community. There are seeds for optimism. There are possibilities that we are beginning to create. We need to work together. We need to create initiatives. We need to create signals. We need to promote goodwill, because they can have a substantial impact. And so in sum, one, the first major problem, I think, from Jewish understanding and its relationship with Islam and Muslims is the problem of ignorance and prejudice within both communities. Two, we have to acknowledge the centrality of the Israeli-Palestinian encounter and work out a way of talking about it without collapsing into polemic and diatribe. And three, we have to acknowledge that we're both minority communities in this country, which provides a real possibility of collaboration, mutual affirmation, and building a distinctive and vibrant minority community in this country. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think Dr. Kessler has touched on some of the points I wanted to raise. So I will focus instead on what can be done to improve the relationship between the two communities. One I would say is to promote encounters between the communities. There are some in the Muslim communities who have not yet met a member of the Jewish community. And likewise, there are some in the Jewish community who have not met or have had any encounter with Muslims. So these encounters will help to dispel some of the misconceptions and misperception that people may have about each other. Well, what do Muslims mean when they speak of jihad, for example? And a Jew or a Christian will be surprised after meeting Muslims and discussing with them that for them jihad is not holy war. And what do they mean by fatwa? It's not a death sentence. It simply means a legal ruling. What do they mean by sharia? It's not the penal courts, you know, the stoning people to death and so forth and so on. It's simply all the basic teachings that were brought by the Prophet. So these are just examples of how such encounters may be very useful in dispelling some of the myths that people may have about Islam and Muslims. And, I mean, talking from my own experience, I was brought up in a part that was predominantly Christian, although everyone in my family were Muslims, my ancestors, everyone were Muslims. But we had Christian friends, so we knew about Christianity. We went to schools where we were studying the Synoptic Gospels. It was part of the primary and high school. We knew about Christianity. So if any kind of information came about which we felt was not accurate, we were able to tell that that's not what Christianity stands for. And we had not seen Jews or even read about Judaism. And in fact, the teaching, even within the Christian traditions on Jews, we were not always very positive representations. We, you know, the verses in the New Testament, we remember, we memorized some of them. And I then went and did my Islamic studies and lived in Muslim countries where, again, my understanding of Jews was based on textual representation of the Jew, religious textual representation. I had not yet come in contact with the Jew. I had seen Jews on TV, and they were Israeli soldiers. And so when I went to university where it was university where you had Jewish students, you also had Muslim students. They were both minorities in a university that was predominantly Christian. And because they were both minorities, and as Muslims, we have specific laws, dietary laws, what we are allowed to eat, what we should not eat. We eat halal. It means something that has been prepared according to Muslim laws. And we are also taught that you can also eat kosher if you cannot find, you know, instead of halal. Halal and kosher are the same, we are told. So because the Jewish students were already organized, they already had their own, we call it a takeaway, a tuck shop, where they sell their own foods. So Muslim students would go to that takeaway and have their meals there. That was the first encounter. So for some of us who already had an image of Jews, would sit down and discuss and say, but you people believe this, you people do this. You know, the chronicles of the elders of Zion, and you want to run the world. And we were often surprised to find out that that wasn't the Judaism they practiced. And even some of the images that we had in our own text, we started challenging those images because of the encounter. And that brings me to the second important point to consider, that within our traditions, whether we are Jews or Muslims, we need to seriously consider the need to interpret our texts within the context of interreligious dialogue and within a pluralistic, multi-faith society. As a result of encounters, if you had read a particular text in your religion that tells you something about the Muslim, or about the Jews or the Christian, then after the encounter, it forces you to rethink that textual representation. Now, I grew up in South Africa where, as you know, the history of that country, it was an apartheid state. That meant people were separated on the basis of their race. If you're black, you lived in certain areas, whites lived in certain areas, and then you had a category called the Indians, lived in certain areas, they were mostly Muslims. And the separation was not on the basis of religion. So that meant if you're Muslim, black, you'll end up with in an area where you had Christian friends, neighbors. And you would also be involved with people maybe from the Jewish faith, those who were involved in the struggle against apartheid. The apartheid system itself was sanctioned on the basis of the Bible. And it was the Dutch Reformed Church that was trying to sanction and justify the racist policies of the state. But because we were already aware of Christianity and Christians through our encounters in school, we knew that this was a manipulation of the text of the Bible. We also knew that while the state was imposing a certain interpretation of the Bible that was racist, there were also people like Desmond Tutu who were using the same Bible as a tool of liberation and social justice. So we had in front of us evidence through those encounters. So it was therefore easy for us when we read our own text that had certain representations of Christians or Jews that we knew that we had to read this text within their proper context. Because it was a situation where interfaith was not just about, you know, meeting your fellow Jews and Christian friends over a cup of tea. It was a matter of life and death. You could not wait and make a decision. For example, if you were living in an area where, you know, the police are coming to round up everyone, you know, the so-called terrorists, those who were members of the various anti-apartheid political organizations, these were Jews, Christians, and Muslims, you would not wait to ask if your neighbor was Christian or Jew before you warned them that they have to, you know, to hide or to run away. And most often it was your Christian neighbors would come and knock at your window and say, it's time to get away. And so you didn't have to think about, you know, this issue that, well, my Quran or my Bible says that I shouldn't associate with this particular person. So you had to reinterpret those texts. Although the texts are there, they won't disappear. There are texts that are problematic within the Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition, texts that can be read in an exclusivity, in a term that tend to exclude others. And the question was how we interpret those texts and how should we interpret those texts. And the last point is to the need to develop relationships which are not dominated by the conflict in the Middle East. The conflict is very important and need to be addressed, but it is possible to develop these relationships which are not dominated by this conflict. And maybe by developing these relationships, there can be ways of trying to debate and discuss how the conflict itself can be resolved. The conflict should not become an obstacle in developing these relationships. And I think I can stop here and, you know, open up for the discussion.
Thank you very much. I must say I'm delighted and relieved to hear that instead of skirting around the great issue of the Middle East, that it's been confronted very centrally by both our speakers. Before we open it out to questions, to say that one of the important barriers but also opportunities is this difficulty, which has been noted in Salaam Shalom too, of actually speaking honestly about these really difficult, intractable issues. And the rule in Salaam Shalom is no blasphemy, no obscenity, no libel, but everything else is open to debate. And there are traditions. Jews are, when you said the Jewish point of view, I thought, well, it's two Jews, three synagogues, as the saying goes, because there is no one Jewish point of view, and I'm sure there's no one Muslim point of view. But there is a culture of disputation and argument within Judaism, which, in my experience, doesn't always sit with the more courtly, particularly Pakistani, tradition of being polite and not wanting to offend, and the British wish not to confront and be impolite. And so sometimes things get rather skirted around. But so it's really important to have an open debate. And with that in mind, I'd like to open this up. And you can also ask Kyle Hannum, who has been witness to a lot of the programs and encounters in Bristol as well, about some of the things that he's experienced too. Someone like to open up, please? Some brave soul.
Perhaps me. I appreciate what you just said. Actually, my organizing in Muslim, Jewish, and Christian relations began because Jewish men were getting up and saying that they were speaking for me, and in fact they weren't. So it is important, I think, to say some Jewish people, or there is a louder perspective out there, something like that. So thank you for pointing that out.
Can you all hear the speaker? Yes.
Speaking of louder.
Okay, I'll repeat. If you give me a question, I'll repeat it and try to summarize.
So also there was a great deal of discussion about the what, but I'm also interested in the how, very much so. I found in my little bit of organizing that we tend to get the same people, the people who are perhaps 99.9% there, and I think that those people are really important because it does become a chain, but how do we get the how do I discuss with my Jewish family who don't agree with me? You know, that's harder for me. I can sit and talk to anyone who agrees with me, regardless of their political or religious faith, but what's the how about the people who don't? Yes, I'll leave.
Okay. Just so those of you who didn't hear, the lady there said that in her organizing spirit she was very pleased to hear that my comments about the multiple perspectives, that there isn't one Jewish view, or although there are obviously Jewish traditions, there's not just one Jewish view. And she's very interested in the how of how we get those who are not naturally inclined or initially inclined to interfaith dialogue or intercultural dialogue to open up and talk, and that it's sometimes harder to speak to your own families about these issues than to speak to intellectual colleagues at your meeting in the academy. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah. I have one other question.
Yes. All right, a quick one, yes.
Okay, good. Since we're in Britain right now, what about the Balfour Declaration? What about the British Mandate?
That's a little one.
Now, is this only a theological discussion, or is this actually quite political?
So is the whole issue simply a matter of interfaith dialogue, or are we talking about a wider political context? And what about that Balfour Declaration as we're in Britain? Should we take one or two more questions and try to, or contributions, because people must have had experiences they would like to share about interfaith dialogue. This gentleman at the back, yes?
If I'm right, and America seems to have been a dominant feature in Jewish-Muslim relations ever since, and I'm conscious that the McCain camp tried to lambast Obama by claiming he was a Muslim, and I'm also conscious that the Americans are major allies and supporters of Israel. So I wonder if there's an American context that needs to be explored. That's my question.
Okay, so should we, to what extent is America at the heart of the Balfour Declaration, and to what extent in contemporary political politics is the whole Middle East agenda dominated by American interests?
And Pakistan.
Right.
Okay.
Shall we? I think that's enough to be getting on with for the moment, don't you?
Do you want me to kick off? Yeah, I thought you would. Okay, absolutely about the variety of Jewish views. There's no doubt. There are about 15 million different Jewish views and about 1.6 billion Muslim views. So I can only speak for myself. Now, the how, I think it's a very important question. And I want to touch on it in terms of going into the mosques from a Jewish perspective, not to be fearful of it, to engage, encounter with Muslims. Michael's talked about the need for personal encounter. Absolutely vital to break down the prejudice and barriers. Prejudice and barriers within one's own community as well as in someone else's community. And my father always said to me, what do we need a Center for Jewish-Christian Relations for when I set it up 10 years ago? We need a Center for Jewish-Jewish Relations. And he's absolutely right. But I do think that in terms of a dialogue, and not just talking theology, but in terms of a dialogue, that in engaging with somebody else, when you look at that person in the eye, you actually learn more about yourself. I learn a great deal about my own Jewish identity in engaging with Christians and more recently in engaging with Muslims. And that's not something I'm fearful of. I think a lot of fear comes out of an ignorance and a lack of security and self-confidence. I think it's essential to build be aware of the commonality. That's where you start. And then you move on to difference, but start with commonality. Balfour Declaration, very briefly, I don't think it's got anything to do with the United States, as far as I know. It's a British government mandate, Lord Balfour, 1917, declaring that there should be a homeland for the Jewish people. enormously controversial statement within the Jewish community as well as wider afield. But the question about America, the United States, is a very, very important one. And the comment I'd like to make, and I'd be interested in what Michael's take on it, is actually, in some ways, the Muslim community in the United States is similar in size to the Jewish community in the United States, about 6 or 7 million, I believe. The dialogue between Jews and Muslims, in some ways, is easier to take place here than it is in the United States, which is so dominated by the Middle East, by Israel, Palestine itself, so dominated by particularly evangelical Christian Southern Baptist positions, the Christian Zionists and so on, dominated by a fear that many Muslims in the United States have, far greater, in my experience, than Muslims in this country. But there's a particular opportunity, I think, in this country because, I was saying before, the issue that we're both minorities in this country, we both face many of the same challenges as minority groups in this country, that we can work together. But
Michael.
Well, I think I'll respond to the question about how to get more people involved in the discussion. Yes, it is true that you often get the same people turning up for discussions on interfaith dialogue. I'm pleased to see that there are a lot of young faces in this room. Usually you get the elderly and who come, and either they are senior members in their various communities. There are people who already believe in the need to engage in this. But the people who need to be taking part the most are the people who don't feel there's a need to get along sometimes, or they just are ignorant about each other's faith. So these are the people who must be involved. The various communities and groups in the UK have been using different strategies to try to bring people in, and some have been using the arts, some sports, some theater, some music, and so that interfaith is not just by coming together and drinking tea and you go back to your mosque or to your synagogue believing that the other person is going to hell, but also to go back with a different perspective about that someone. Because what I always say, my own position on this, is that I sometimes feel that there is the need to be polite in interfaith work. They need to be politically correct, and that undermines the need to engage in real dialogue. And people will not say certain things because they are afraid to offend, and they will not ask certain questions because they don't want to be seen as being, bigoted or something, when those are the questions that are actually important. So what you have at the end are people who come together, they have tea, they exchange, they have cakes and they go home, and they stand in front of the, whether it is in the church or the synagogue or in the mosque, and they preach that message that they are the only ones going to paradise, and their friends they were having tea with yesterday are going to hell. So interfaith become like a PR exercise, where you show that you're doing something in the community. So maybe there has to be a way of encouraging more, I think, through kind of education of the what Ed called the basic faith literacy of some sort, having a basic understanding about other faith. And I think in my own experience, I just mentioned that I thought I knew about, I knew, of course, about Christians because we had friends who were Christians, and we didn't know much about Jews and Judaism. We thought we knew, and because the information was coming from our own sources. By our own sources, I mean classical and medieval Muslim writings about Judaism and Jews. And we then found out that that wasn't always an accurate representation, and our Jewish friends we met later on, they were saying, well, we don't recognize ourselves in that picture of the Jew that you have. So we were forced to revisit those texts to see what is actually happening when these texts are being produced. So I think that is one of the ways of...
I'm just wondering if we could open this up to Carl, because you mentioned the arts as one avenue for engaging people. And one of the things that Salam Shalom Radio does is to host various music programs, including a lot of fusion music. And also, Carl, you mentioned that story about the supporting the person who did, from a Muslim person who tried to initiate interfaith dialogue and was victimized by his own community for doing that. And I'm sure there reverse examples and the kind of support. So perhaps you'd like to say something.
Yeah, we get lots of emails from people who hear about what we do and then they email us and say, great, or yeah, but how can it work here? This goes back to your question. We had an email from a Jewish lady in South Africa where, as Sheikh Michael was pointing out, the Jewish community there has a long history of anti-apartheid campaigning. In fact, one of the first people we interviewed on Radio Salam Shalom was someone, a member of the Jewish community in South Africa, who'd been exiled from South Africa because of his support for the armed wing of the ANC. And we had an email from a Jewish lady in South Africa who said, I have a Muslim friend who has been ostracized by his fellow Muslims because he has been seen by his Muslim community as someone who's trying to reach out to other communities, especially Jews. They don't like it. What can I tell him that makes him feel better about his interfaith initiatives? The work he's doing seems to be positive, but his own community don't see it that way. In fact, they've treated him in an entirely negative fashion. What can I say to him to convince him that he, in his interfaith work, is on the right path? I'd love to know what to respond.
Does anyone have any suggestions about that?
Looks like the ball's in your court.
Yes?
It's not a direct response, but I wonder the aspect of this being, could be described as a secular society rather than a Christian society. Although our traditions are Christian, numerically, we probably have to recognize it's a secular society. And therefore, interfaith is itself a minority sport. And whether the context in which these discussions are taking place hasn't taken on board that broader picture in this country, that a minority is feeling defensive in a big ocean, but actually that's more in common with the Jewish community than perhaps with the totality of
it. Could everyone hear that? Yes, okay.
One of the reasons we talk about interfaith relations is it's not interreligious relations. There's a deliberate choice of term faith, because people can identify with a faith without necessarily being a practicing, religiously observant person. So you're right in terms of the growing secularization of this country, but nevertheless, in the last census, 72% or so ticked the box Christian. They identified as Christians, even though only about 8% go to church. So I think I would be very careful, and I think you were sort of alluding to it earlier, to sort of categorize interfaith work simply as a sort of minority sport or of interest only to religious-minded people. Because the sorts of people who engage in interfaith relations are a whole array of those who are observant and those who are not observant. And I think it's terribly important to actually reach as wide an audience as possible, because we hang on to these labels. It's what we know. We carry these hybrid labels and identities, one of which is of a faith tradition.
Michael, would you agree with that?
Well, yes, of course, yeah. The aspect of hybridity is, I think, is important. That people did not want to accept until recently, maybe after 9/11, that there are a lot of people in their own countries, whether it is here or elsewhere, for whom faith is a very important category of their identities. It's, for them, it's not just the ethnicity that matters, or even gender, but the faith itself is important. And societies were not prepared to deal with that, secular societies. And, for example, in the Home Office here in the UK, there was a faith department responsible for looking at aspects of faith. They didn't have anyone who was trained, actually had any religious training. And there were usually social scientists who looked at religion just as a social category. And, the aspect of faith, the fact that people can identify themselves on the basis of their faith was not considered or taken seriously. But we know that there are a lot of people for whom faith is central to their identity and not their ethnicity. You ask some people, they'll tell you, I'm Muslim, and they won't say I'm Arabic or I'm this for them. And of course, some may tell you, well, I'm Arab, I'm Pakistani, I'm this. But if you ask them, most people would say I'm Muslim first before they can say anything else. So it is, I think, an important issue to consider.
Yes, and then you.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you, as I'm a teacher of religious studies with teenagers, and I'm very interested in this idea of basic faith literacy that you spoke about. You both seem to be hinting that you feel that authentic personal encounters are maybe one of the best ways to establish genuine understanding of another faith, which I agree with. But I also like the fact that you have brought out the problem of being PC, because as a teacher I have to be very careful that nobody's offended. That it's just that balance of getting a genuine dialogue where children can talk, but the fear that parents are going to come back. And because if you let children loose and really have open dialogue, things will be said, but then it's hard maybe to rein back in. Just wondering how you feel about guiding talks like that.
We've just come back from a
Sorry, could everyone hear that? Yes.
The issue is about, I guess, a sort of honesty in allowing people to say what they really think, and the dangers of that, as well as the process. We've Michael and I have just been involved in teaching the Metropolitan Police for 2 days on interfaith relations in preparation for delivering the Olympics. It took at least 3 hours before there was a sense of safe space that they could ask any question. You know, I kept on saying, the only foolish question is the one you haven't asked. You've got to be able to ask any question. You're absolutely right that we are almost shackled by this PC culture. We do need to be able to take on difficult questions, not necessarily answer them, but acknowledge these particular questions are the key questions. So I don't have experience that you have in terms of school education, primary or secondary, but my experience in terms of actual being involved practically in the dialogue is to try and create that space where difficult, offensive questions can be asked of me, because I'd rather that question was asked so that we can actually unpack it and tackle it and ask what's behind it. And one of the questions that was asked what's the Muslim view on women? Yeah? And you can see, unpacking. Let's unpack that question first. Where's that question coming from? What are you trying to get at? And then see, as you know, the whole range of different views that exist on the Muslim Islamic feminism and so on. But, I mean...
Yes. Yeah, I think, you're absolutely right. Maybe it's different when you're dealing with children. Our experience, I don't have any experience dealing with children.
They're running up to 18, so it is an important age as well. I mean, they're 12 to 18, so you're hoping to prepare them to go into...
Yes. Yes. We have worked with that age, and we often try to create that safe space where they can ask these questions. If they are 18, or 17, 16, 18, they often ask the difficult questions, whether they are Muslim or Jews or Christian. In Birmingham, there's a college, it's a sixth form college, where there was conflict which led to violence between the Muslim students and the Christian society or something. And we were invited to come and see if we could, arbitrate and lock them up in a room like this and say, let's discuss. And so a lot of questions were asked, and people realized that most of these things were rumors, misunderstanding, and, you know, gossip and so forth and so on. And people asked very open questions. And the same happened at Leeds University, where they invited an evangelical who came and gave a talk on Islam and women. And Muslim students found this to be a distortion of Islam position on women. And that again led to serious conflict, and then they had to invite Muslims to come and bring again the two groups together and present the Muslim response to that. And that again led to a lot of discussion, but at the end people were able to have a kind of conversation. They didn't agree, but they were able to talk.
We have one more question than a written question that I would like to be addressed. So if you could...
Yes, I was very interested in what Michael said about the need to interpret texts in the context of dialogue, to look again at original texts. And I've got to this modern translation of Quran open. Surah 5, where there's quite a lot of talk between Muslims and Jews. If only the people of the scripture, the Jews and the Christians, would believe, if only they would observe what their Torah and gospel say, then everything would be all right. Well, it doesn't say it quite like that, but that's the implication. Would Muslims still think that about the Jews and their scriptures? If only the Jews would keep to their scriptures, things would be a lot better. Well, how are the Jewish scriptures regarded by Muslims today?
Well, as an article of faith, one of the articles of faith, what makes a person a Muslim, is that you have to believe that God revealed scriptures to Moses, and these are the Jewish scriptures, and also to Jesus, the what they call the Injil. You know, and if a Muslim rejects that, and it means he ceases to be a Muslim. In order to be a Muslim, you have to believe that God sent revelation to Moses and to Jesus. So it is an article of faith, and all Muslims believe that. Now, there may be disagreement among Muslims whether those revealed scriptures still exist the way they were revealed. Then you have some who say, well, there was a lot of, they were changed later on, and they were corrupted because they were being transmitted orally and so forth and so on. But they believe in the concept, in the doctrine that God sent revelation to his prophets, and among his prophets is Moses and Jesus.
But haven't those 19th century ideas about the Jewish scriptures been corrected now? With the good scholarship we have available, we know actually that the Jewish scriptures are virtually as they were originally, and that the claim that they've been changed or corrupted doesn't stand, actually, does it?
Well, Muslims have not spent time doing this kind of biblical criticism. It's not really their area. They've spent a lot of time doing textual study of Islamic texts, authenticating Islamic texts. They've even gone into the business of trying to authenticate, Christian or Jewish texts. So it is an area that they have not, been involved in. They are aware, some of them, of modern scholarship on the Bible, and they do have different views, and there is no one Muslim view on this topic. What they have in common is that they all believe in the concept of revelation to Moses and to Jesus. And what happened with that revelation, they have differences of opinion among them. Just as you have differences of opinion among people in the Jewish faith, that you have some who also have the same view as Muslims, that revelation changed. Then you have others who believe that it is still the same. The revelation to Moses hasn't changed at all.
Just a quick comment.
I think one thing that brings out is the problem of what's called supersessionism that exists in Christian-Jewish relations, known as replacement theology, where Christianity replaced Judaism, and exists in Jewish-Christian-Muslim relations, with Islam seeing itself as the fulfillment of Judaism and Christianity. Mm. And it is an issue in terms of the text that you quoted. Mm. And I think it's one of those things that we need to put on the table in the Muslim-Jewish conversation, and how do we handle that? How do we get to a point where we can actually affirm one another, yes, without losing our identity or as Jews or as Muslims? I mean, just because the Jewish texts were, the Bible was earlier than either the New Testament or the Quran, doesn't mean there aren't Jewish problems with issues over, for instance, chosen people and what that means. But the issue of supersessionism, which has been a big one in Christian-Jewish relations over the years, also exists in terms of the Islamic understanding of itself as the fulfillment of the Jewish and Christian writings.
And I'd like to turn to a question now, thank you, that was written, and then I'll take the question posed over there. The questioner says, please define Zionism, the, quote, safe Jewish homeland that you speak of, Edward, seems to be an ever-expanding phenomenon with ever-expanding borders. How does Israel justify Jewish settlements? They claim settlements are necessary to house increasing Jewish population. How then can Israel reconcile Jewish settlements policy with Jewish law of return? And does a wealthy Jew from Europe have more right to live in Palestine, now Israel, than a Palestinian refugee? Okay. Now we're getting to the... right.
I think the first thing is to make a genuine attempt, whether one's a Christian or a Muslim or whatever faith, to understand the Jewish attachment to the land and state of Israel. And then a conversation can begin. Why do Jews have an attachment to the land of Israel? Because it comes from the Bible, the biblical promise originally, promised to Abraham, to give the land to Abraham's children. It comes from a Jewish attachment to the land of Israel from its very origins through the present day. It comes from Jewish association and life and living in the land from biblical times to the present day in different numbers. It comes from the identity and the core fact, the fact that core to Jewish identity, one core of Jewish identity, is connection to the land of Israel. Jewish identity is a very complicated phenomenon, as all our identities are, but one aspect of it is the land and state of Israel. Now, modern political Zionism as a recent phenomenon, not simply Zionism and attachment to the land, but modern political Zionism began in the mid-19th century, 1860s, 1870s, as a kind of reaction, really, to modern European nationalism, for those of you who are studying it, and particularly with the increase in anti-Semitism in Europe, it generated further interest amongst Jews in going to live and return to the land of Israel, eventually culminating in the creation of, in 1947, under UN mandate, a creation of a Jewish state, the State of Israel, and a creation of a stillborn Palestinian state. That is, if you're in a nutshell, Jewish attachment to Israel and its creation in its early period. Now, in terms of contemporary Israeli policy, I think that Jews, if you look at the pages of the Jewish Chronicle, you'll notice the disputation I think Madge referred to is alive and kicking. There are a whole variety of Jewish views about Israeli policy, some of which are very critical and some of which are less so. As far as borders are concerned, if you look at the Bible, you can choose whichever border you want. The Bible is not clear about the borders. The borders of the ancient land of Israel could spread as far as Damascus. And clearly that's not practical in a modern context. Now, it seems to me, as a Jew living in Cambridge, that it's easy from my little safe ivory tower here, but it seems to me that if there is to be a Jewish state in the land of Israel, and there needs to be a Jewish state, there only needs to be one Jewish state where Jews can live, but a Jewish state in the land of Israel, you cannot have democracy, you cannot have a Jewish state, and you cannot have the widest possible borders. They do not go together. So if you're going to have a Jewish state, and it's going to be a democracy, it's got to be within borders that are acceptable, and it's got to be alongside a Palestinian state. That's my personal viewpoint. I am not a fan of increasing settlements, but what I am a fan of, whoever we are, is I'm a fan of going there, meeting Israelis, meeting Palestinians, seeing the complexity on the ground, and realizing that the only way forward, the only solution there's going to be, is when there's a genuine understanding of both the attachment, Jewish attachment to the land and state of Israel, and the needs of the Palestinians in and alongside the land of Israel.
Michael.
No response.
No response. If I might be allowed as a more secular Jew, because it's interesting what you said about the Zionism, modern Zionism, as a response to growing anti-Semitism in Europe, and researching the newspapers in the 19th century, you realized how despised and beleaguered people without a state were. And it's interesting that in the 1960s, before the 67 war, there was a resurgence in Zionism, and I think as an American student at that time, it was very much a response to the Black Power movement and the idea of having an identity where you weren't ashamed of what you were and trying to reclaim. It's bound up with gender, too, and masculinity and not being a victim and not simply walking to the gas chambers. So there it's a very, very fraught thing, grounded more in fear than you would realize, a very complicated one. And not all Jews certainly support the Jewish settlements. In fact, Israel's on the brink of civil war over these issues.
There's a lovely story told by one of our patrons, Prince Hassan of Jordan, who says that Shimon Peres, when he was foreign minister, went to visit him in Amman and said, Your Royal Highness, you don't know how difficult it is for us Israelis to give up territory, to give up land for peace, because we're surrounded by enemies, we're surrounded by people who want to throw us into the sea. And Prince Hassan replied, he said, Mr. Foreign Minister, he said, you don't know how lucky you are. You are surrounded by enemies. I am surrounded by friends.
But I think that fear, that siege mentality, is something that people from the outside who see wealthy Jews don't understand, that paranoia, that fear, that insecurity. And unless that's addressed, I think dialogue doesn't go forward. But thank you very much for that question, lady there.
My question is to do with the nexus between political action and policy and the kind of grassroots work that both of you seem to do, which is kind of more individual interfaith dialogue. And I'm also wondering, so first of all, I'm wondering how that interfaith dialogue translates
into
policy changes. And secondly, how perceived political inequalities, both in the diaspora and in America, and I'm thinking of the 2006-2007, the Israeli lobby, for example, how perceived the larger political inequalities impact on the kind of grassroots work you do?
So the two questions really are, how does that grassroots person-to-person kind of individual encounter stuff actually translate into real policy, and how do the perceived inequalities, or the real inequalities as they're perceived in the Middle East or elsewhere, affect the kind of interfaith work and dialogue work that you do? Michael, would you like to?
There is, especially in the UK, there is a very strong link between grassroots interfaith activities and, policy, whether those, particularly the government is investing a lot into interfaith work. Ed just mentioned that even various departments, the Metropolitan Police in London, they are now trying to find out what they can learn from interfaith in order to prepare themselves for the Olympics, because you'll have people coming from Muslim countries, and it will be also during the Olympics will take place during the fasting month, of Ramadan. They have to consider all these issues, and it will also be the time, the anniversary of the Munich attacks, So all these issues, I think, affect the work that people do in public policy. And there have been so many examples in the UK that you can go on listing where these kind of grassroots initiatives had an impact on public policy eventually.
I think the very fact that there are now courses, say, on Muslim-Jewish relations, which are taken not just by observant Jews and Muslims, but by a whole range of people, including non-Muslims and non-Jews, Christians and others, indicates that people can see there's some relevance to the work that they do. That I think if you have the tools of understanding of another faith in whatever profession you have, whether you're an academic or a teacher or a minister of religion or a police officer, it will help you in the work that you do, because the interfaith challenge and faith in the broader sense of faith is the challenge of our time. It is the challenge of our time. Now, I didn't quite understand the question about perceived inequalities, but if I understand it right, I think the very perception is the reality that you have to deal with. So if someone tells me that they've read the Elders of the Protocols of Zion and they believe there's a Jewish conspiracy, I have to deal with that reality. It's no point me saying, don't be so bloody ridiculous. I have to try and unpack where that's coming from, as much as that ignorance and anti-Semitic baggage that it carries. Or likewise, that all Muslims want to bring in Sharia, an extreme form of an understanding of Sharia. Where does that come from? So the perception is what we have to deal with. And I just think we just have to be open and honest and confident in our dealing with that, and hope that we can have the generosity of our partner in the conversation to listen to where we're coming from. Don't have to agree, but listen and identify those issues. But I'm not quite sure if that answers your question.
One of the things I would like to add is that, particularly speaking to a university-based audience, is the importance of comparative materials when people are dealing with ethnic minorities, or religious minorities, not to have them in a box. One of the things, I've just finished a lottery-funded project on 1,001 years of ethnic minorities in Bristol, and the having to look across that wide time span and comparing Jewish experience with Muslim experience in in the South Asian context in the 21st century, 20th and 21st century, brings certain parallels. Now, if you can put that into a form that can be translated into schools, readily accessible for teachers, that kind of thing will help to inform policy. I mean, I think there's it is very hard to translate individual encounters into anything that's lasting, and that's why we have to amass academic research in a publicly accessible form. The kind of arts work and the kind of radio work, those sort of things are really, really important now to get a basis for dialogue. Yes?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, dialogue is one thing, talking at least is not debating, it's dialogue, that's true. But what do you feel is the real aim of intimate dialogue? Because I feel it's very easy to misinterpret it and to feel that the aim is just actually multi-religion, side by side, respecting each other, tolerating each other. Do you think interfaith dialogue can actually go any further than just respecting other religions?
Can interfaith dialogue go any further than just respecting other religions? Michael?
Yeah, I think it can go further than just that. It depends, on context. And within the South African context, it was important in removing the apartheid system. So you had people, because the apartheid system didn't discriminate on the basis of your religion. It was on the basis of your race, and it was a dehumanizing system. So you had people from different religious traditions coming together, and some of them didn't believe in God. You had the Marxists, you had the communists, you had Muslims, you had Jews, and you had Christians, and some who would simply say they are Christians, not because they are Christians, but they were trying to say, I'm not Muslim. Especially in these countries, that's what often happens. They're actually not really practicing Christian. They practice what we call African traditional religion. Because African traditional religions were not recognized by anthropologists as religions as such, so if you ask what is your religion, they'll say, I'm Christian. Because you caught them off guard. They're actually not Christian. They're simply trying to say, I'm not Muslim, or I'm not, all the other religions. So you had actually interfaith working. And also you have the Jubilee, I think, some of the kind of programs to eradicate poverty, where you had people from religious groups coming together to initiate change, make poverty history, and all the other campaigns, and you also have aid and relief work, Christian aid, and you've got Islamic relief, where Islamic relief is involved in distributing relief in areas that are not Muslim, maybe Christian areas. You've got Christian aid working in Muslim countries, and likewise, you have all these kind of activities taking place.
So, mutual projects that people contribute to is what you're saying?
Yes, they are actual projects that are taking place where you see people of different faith coming together. We may not be aware of these projects, or we may actually not be even be aware that they are religious projects where different... You have got Salam Shalom as an example, a radio station. Salam means peace in Arabic, then Shalom is peace in Hebrew. And you've got these two communities coming together, and they do more than just entertain people with radio. They have got other projects they do. So there are many ways in which interfaith manifests itself.
I mean, I think that interfaith dialogue isn't simply about having samosas and bagels. It's not just that kind of tolerance, if you like. It's about a genuine attempt to understand somebody else's position and viewpoint. And these are critical issues. Whether it's about Israel-Palestine, which is so important to Jews and Muslims, or other things as well. So it's about a genuine attempt to listen to the other person, to understand the position of the other person, and then move on from that, that it has some impact and some consequence, such as in public policy, for example. I mean, I think there's a genuine sense that true interfaith dialogue, and I don't mean that theologically, but in a genuine conversation, is understanding that other person, how that person is different from you, and how you can build bridges with that person and come to some kind of resolution if there's a conflict with that person. I think in today's fairly unsettled world, we tend to either dismiss interfaith dialogue or be a bit depressed about it. And I don't think, I think actually quite the other, I think one's got to be quite optimistic about it. I mean, a story is told about three elderly Jews who meet every afternoon in Jerusalem. and they look around them, and all they see is economy is a mess, and there's tourism, there's violence, and there seems to be preparing for another war, and they decide they're three pessimists. And one day, one of them turns around and says, "You know what, I've converted." And they say, "What do you mean you've converted?" He said, "I've become an optimist." And they say, how could you become an optimist? It's such a terrible world, so many terrible things happening. He said, "No, you've got to accept me for who I am. I'm now an optimist." And they do. And a few minutes later, they look at this newly converted optimist, and he's got a few grey hairs, a few wrinkles, a few frowns, and they say to him, "Why do you look so worried if you're an optimist?" And he said, "Do you think it's easy to be an optimist?" And I think that's where we are. I think we have no other choice than to be optimistic. It's not easy to be optimistic, but there's a lot more than we realise to be optimistic about, particularly in the Muslim-Jewish conversation.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there because time has run out, but I'd like to thank our speakers for their honest and frank, and to all of you for your questions.
And that's where it ended, an hour's worth of very interesting discussions on the state of play, Muslim and Jewish relations, all part of the Cambridge Festival of Ideas, which is currently on in Cambridge right now. It's Radio Salam Shalom's Muslim and Jewish podcast, and it's not over yet, because after the discussion, I managed to catch up with Sheikh Mamisa and asked him whether there were any questions he was expecting which he didn't get.
Well, I think people asked most of the questions that we were expecting, and I cannot say maybe there were certain questions that were left out. We had enough time to explore all the questions, and I think all the questions were very relevant to the current debate on, you know, the role of faith in society. There were questions about if interfaith at all can influence public policy, and the conflict in the Middle East. Questions were asked about that. So people asked some very frank and honest questions. What I hope is that they realized that interfaith issues are not something that a certain group of people, you know, do to pass away time, but they are actually very important for our communities, even whether you're Muslim, Jew, or Christian, or even if you don't believe in God at all. It is important to be aware or to have the basic required information and knowledge about other people who define themselves on the basis of faith.
Sheikh Michael Mamisa from the CMJR, the Centre for Muslim and Jewish Relations, at the Wolf Institute of Cambridge University. I also spoke to the Institute's Dr. Kessler and asked him whether Cambridge was the right place for this kind of discussion.
I've never been asked that question before. I think it is the right place because we've got a small number of very dynamic people who are willing to engage in a serious and open conversation. The benefit, of course, of being in Cambridge is you have the academic resources available. And also, there are a sufficient number of interested students and local people, a significant Muslim community in Cambridge and in Peterborough and in the environment, a significant number of Jews in Cambridge and also in the area of Essex. So it's a good location, yes. You never quite know what you're going to get, particularly in a Muslim-Jewish conversation. I thought the questions were thoughtful. There's always a question about Israel-Palestine. I'm glad it didn't dominate because everyone has such strong views about it and that we're able to explore other aspects of the Muslim-Jewish encounter, including the artistic and the cultural aspects, not just the religious and the theological dimensions. So that was encouraging. I suppose we answered the questions that weren't asked, if you know what I mean. I was keen to talk about Muslim-Jewish relations in this country, for instance, although we weren't asked about it, just to emphasize what we share in common here and the possibilities of building a vibrant diaspora minority community that we can.
At the Center for Muslim-Jewish Relations, the CMJR, what lies ahead over the next couple of months? Any big events? Any other dialogues we could share?
There's one event, well, there's always, I'm pleased to say, lots of events that will interest you and the listeners. Two things coming on in addition to the normal talks and classes. One is a conference with Islamic Relief, World Jewish Relief and Christian Aid called Keeping Faith in Development. And we're bringing them together for them to talk about what it's like to deliver aid in countries of a different faith than their own. So Christian Aid working with Muslims in the Philippines, World Jewish Relief working in Pakistan, and Islamic Relief working in southern Sudan with Christians. And this has very much come to the fore, of course, because of the terrible murder in Afghanistan of a young Christian woman. And there will be quite a lot of coverage in the weekend's media on this. And that's going to be in December, so that should be a really interesting one, and you'll be most welcome to come along. In the summer of next year, we're running a conference entitled Jews in Arab Lands, which is going to look at the Jewish contribution to Arabic literature in a number of different countries, such as Iraq, some of the North African countries in the Middle East. And that should be really exciting, because the story we tend to hear about Jews in Arab lands is expulsions after the creation of the State of Israel. And there's another story to be told, this real rich history of Arab Jews.
And that's it for this special edition of the Radio Salam Shalom Jewish Muslim podcast. You can download podcasts absolutely free from many places on the internet. They're on the website at salamshalom.org.uk, and you can also subscribe via iTunes or many other podcast subscription services. Absolutely free, and there's a new podcast every fortnight. You can email us at info@salamshalom.org.uk, and of course, if you'd like to contribute to Salam Shalom, then all you need to do is email us at the same email address, info@salamshalom.org.uk. Now, Radio Salam Shalom is a charity, and our volunteers are always happy to know that there are people not only listening, but willing to help them do what they do just that little bit more easily. And that means any contributions are absolutely welcome. Contributions of program ideas, contributions of suggestions for music, or perhaps you'd like to record a part of your own show and send it to us, and perhaps we can use it here on the next podcast. And naturally, if you'd like to make a donation to Salam Shalom, you'll find out full details of how to contribute financially to what we're doing here. Details are on the website at salamshalom.org.uk. Just look for the link to support us. That's it for another fortnight. Salam Shalom. This is Radio Salam Shalom.